of that right.
Okay. We slowly worked out the mathematics of this, which we'll have to do some checking. Because this is peer-reviewed material, as you guys know. Everything about the TechNet is reported by Mike number one, Mike Perry, KC2NJI, and you can read about that by going to amateurradio.tangovictor. Amateurradio.tangovictor. Mike has recorded the last 12 or 13 years of the TechNet. At least I think it's 12 or 13, or is it 20? Let's see now. Three, four, six. Yeah, I think it's 12 years. The last 12 years. You choose the right year, the right month, the right week. You can play back all these TechNets. And there are people who do that. And there is another website that supports this TechNet, which is Mike number 2, K1MJM, which is TechNet LimeRockTechNet.com. LimeRockTechNet.com. Or is it TechNet LimeRock? I think it's LimeRockTechNet.com. So, lots of supporting information. So, when we make a mistake, people let us know about it pretty soon. You need any further information on what we're trying to derive here, Steve? Interesting question you've asked. KD2HUC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Nope, I'm gonna digest that. And basically, my takeaway is that it's obviously easier to make a broadband solid state amplifier than tube. And I guess with the newer technology, it's probably worth it more to invest in that than trying to do it with a tube. So, fair enough. Appreciate the information. KDT HUC, back to net.
M2EOTIC.
Steve, there's a yes and no to what you just said. If I wanted a 1500 watt peak envelope power output amplifier, an afterburner, 80 through 10 meters, and I wanted it to have a very wide frequency, a very wide impedance matching characteristics. In other words, sometimes my antenna has got a 4 to 1 standing wave ratio. I've got a dipole on 80 meters. It does a pretty good job in the center of the band, but at the edges of the band, it's a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio. And I want the amplifier to be forgiving. They can tolerate short circuits and open circuits. Sometimes I've got the antenna disconnected. I might very well choose a tube amplifier for that operation. There are other people who are very solid-state enthusiastic, and so they want that amplifier to be 1,500 watts peak envelope power output solid-state. They're going to pay a lot more money for it, in my opinion. And if it doesn't have a good protection circuit, it's quite a lot more vulnerable. That solid-state amplifier, if you make the mistake of transmitting into an open circuit, you can wipe out an awful lot of silicon. I think some people are going to disagree with my opinions on this one. My experience is with tube amplifiers. So in the high-power region, I think tubes are a little bit more forgiving.
Repeater, time out.
The power supply for that kilowatt class of solid-state amplifier is an interesting piece of engineering, which can give you some grief. So I know there are people with opinions on this one. The first guy with an opinion might be Rich. N2EO? If you needed a 1,500 watt amplifier afterburner, and you didn't want to spend a lot of money, and you wanted it to be forgiving, and you wanted it to be fairly new, would you choose tube or solid state? N2EO, K2RIW?
Okay, Dick, I have one. It's tube. A pair of 3-500s. What I like about that amplifier, the newer tube amplifiers use like an 8874 or an 8877, and if you wipe that out, you know, they're very, very expensive. What I like about the 3500Z, they're originally made by iMac. I have Chinese tubes in there. They're working fine. They were maybe, I forget, a couple hundred or $100 a piece. Compared to, what's the price now? $1,200 for an 8877?
sounds like you had the choice. Because of your experience with tubes, you chose tubes. The tubes are not a super high price to replace, whereas a failure of the solid-state amplifier, I think that would really push the limit of your repair capability. A 1,500-watt solid-state amplifier, if you wiped out the final stage by transmitting into an open circuit by mistake, I think that would be a pretty elaborate and pretty expensive repair. What do you think, Rich? N2EO, K2LIW.
Hey,
you're
doing,
Rich Ferguson and Eric in that order. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, well, I have a lot of protection. Talk to Bob, W2OSR. He bought a solid-state amplifier. I forget the name of the company. They have an office in this country. It's made in Bulgaria. And they bring them over here. But he said they're very nice amplifiers. They are expensive, but they have a lot of protection for the transistors. Now, in my case, I have a Henry radio. I bought it from Barry and 2MB a couple of years ago. It needed a little bit new tubes, which I got from Henry Radio. And that a 2-year warranty, except glass breakage. Also, it needed a little work. The adjustment had to be redone on the antenna relay. Somebody had bent one of the contacts. Anyway, Hal, K6DPC, gave me a hand with that. He did a very good job on fixing it right at my house. And also, it needed a new honeycomb filter in the back where, because it sucks air up from a squirrel cage fan. And do you know Henry radios stick to the parts even though they're out of the ham radio business?
Sounds like it's some rather good results overall with a tube amplifier. KE2EJ, K2IW, I know that when it comes to FET-like high-power dual transistors per package, you've worked with a lot of these amplifiers, and you've got a lot of solid-state high-power broadcast transmitter experience, so I know you would favor solid-state over tubes. I bet there's a couple of other reasons why you would favor it. KE2EJ, K2IW, go ahead, Eric.
WK2J. Well, if it was 10 years ago, I would tend to agree with you, but no more. I'll show you. This you can buy for $200 as opposed to an 8877, which I'd like to see you find one for under $600 or $700. It'll produce 1.5 kilowatts CW, actually. It uses 50 volt supply. Pretty easy. You only need filtering, especially if you're doing class A, B, or C, C. But even still, and you can put a dead short on the dumb thing, and all your output circuitry will fry. But the solid state device doesn't care. It'll take a 20-to-1 output standing ratio and just dissipate it as heat. It's amazing; it doesn't break. It's also flatter than a tube, that's for sure. Well, it depends upon the kind of circuitry you put it in. And there's a number of demonstrations you would have done in HF, BHF, UHF, where they run it into an open or they run it into a short, and this is without any kind of visual protection, so the transistor survives. So that's the interesting thing. I mean, you get a lot of bang for your few dollars that you're going to spend, and if you actually do decide to put some real protection on it, it'll last a lifetime.
Okay, it's a very desirable sounding solid-state amplifier you're describing, 1,200 watts or something like that, peak envelope power output, even CW, I think you said, and can tolerate almost an open circuit for some ridiculous length of time. Worst case is you might burn up, you said, just the output circuitry, not the device itself, which I think you're talking about. printed circuit like components, which are probably not too expensive to replace. Is that amplifier a no-tune amplifier? I mean, do you do something to that amplifier when you switch from 80 meters to 10 meters? KE2EJ, K2RAW.
Yeah, like a BLF 881. That'll produce 1200 watts at 3 megahertz. Yeah, you are going to change something. You're going to change the low pass filter on the output to keep the harmonic energy out of it, but that's it. They're basically broadband devices. I mean, you can make it without the filters, but I wouldn't go on the air without it.
So it sounds like it's essentially a no-tune amplifier. What happens when I put that into a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio? Depending on the phase angle, my power output changes. If it's got no tuning, I'm guessing that to really get full performance out of that amplifier, you'd have to put it into an antenna tuning network. Isn't that true, Eric? Go ahead.
No, let's put it this way. It's a constant impedance output of 50 ohms, you know, properly designed. If the antenna don't look like 50 ohms, you got to make it look like 50 ohms. You want to get maximum energy transfer out of it.
So I do have to buy a 1200 watt antenna tuner, but they're fairly popular these days. And if you and I were crafty enough, we could homebrew that antenna tuner. There's no rocket science in there. It's just buying the right components and put it into a big enough box. If you wanted a kilowatt class antenna tuner, and if you weren't as rich as you are, Eric, and having some fun with him, would you build or buy a 1500 watt antenna tuner? Over to you, Eric.
Oh, you can buy them now. You can buy them from MFJ, although I wouldn't. The hard part about that is, you know, either you make your own rotary inductor if you're going to be down, going those frequencies went down that low, and then you got to find yourself some vacuum variable capacitors, because that kind of energy in open airspace, if it gets a little humid or something like that, I really wouldn't be too happy around it.
Yeah, you're suggesting that on a humid day, an airtight variable capacitor is going to arc over. Turns out that the breakdown voltage of air almost doesn't depend on humidity. Within reason, if there's droplets of water in there, oh yes, of course it's going to arc over. But a humid day versus a dry day, the actual volts per centimeter, 30,000 volts per centimeter, dielectric strength of air is almost the same, which is not good common sense, but that's just the way it does work. So,
argument.
Say it again.
I have no argument with that, but when you put it in a box and it happens to be a humid day, the temperature changes, it starts condensing inside. And I just went through, I got to tell you this funny story. It's a dim connector on one of my transmitters, and somebody wasn't careful about putting it back together and bent one of the pins, and it's got a kilowatt going through it. And it was fine for 3 days. On the fourth day, when the air temperature inside the connector got a little higher and it was a little more humid in the room, it decided to arc over and melt everything around it.
Your dim connector, was that rather large connector that's used on cell sites called a 716th DIN? Is that the kind of connector you're talking about?
Yeah, it is. And there's a couple different types. The type that they typically use on that, where the outer ground connection is little fingers rather than a solid, round hunk of metal. And the guy who put it together wasn't very careful and bent it a lot closer towards the center conductor.
When it comes to fingers being bent in funny ways, I recently ran into a situation where a type N female-to-female adapter had been purchased at a flea market at a very good price, and somebody put it into a repeater service.
75-ohm pin?
That's it. It was a 75-ohm female-to-female type N adapter. It looks the same if you don't look carefully. But you take a 50-ohm type N male connector and screw it into that female. The female of a 75 ohm connector has got a very small hole, very fine pins, and so the pins got broken, were splashing out, and essentially touching the shield. And so crazy intermittents were occurring in this repeater until, people were replacing all kinds of things trying to find out why the repeater on various days worked well and didn't work well. So with very small temperature changes, those semiconductor pins that had been spread out and were touching the outer conductor, they didn't touch depending on the temperature of the day. So it was a very difficult troubleshoot. All kinds of things were replaced before somebody finally looked down that piece of cable and said, gee, that doesn't look right. Okay. I think we've gone through almost as much as that as we wanted to. I know that Joe had some further information he wanted to give us. W2RYY, K2RYW. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, this is a little bit of a technical story. I got involved with looking for a pirate radio station many years ago because a friend of mine was a pilot. He still is. He was coming back into Republic Airport, and when flying over the northwest area of Long Island coming into that area, sometimes you'd get a garbling going across the frequency. I believe Republic is on like 118.8. See, the 118.8 or 118.0. I think it's 118.8. And he was, you know, complaining about this problem, and he told me about it. So I listened on frequency. I couldn't hear anything up in my house whatsoever. So I loaded up my test equipment in the car, and just looking around for the thing. And what it turns out was, I had to drive all the way into the city, New York City. That's where it was coming from. There was a guy in Hollis, Queens, running a transmitter at 97.5 megahertz. He's co-channel with one of the stations out here in the center of Suffolk County. But I guess out there it's like a blank spot on the dial, playing Haitian music on that frequency. And what this guy was doing was he was putting out a spur about 40 kilohertz away from 118.8. But being that he's running FM modulation, his modulation would splash across 118.8. And you're listening on an AM receiver, rather narrowband AM receiver. And it would basically just wipe out the traffic controller from being heard in the aircraft. And a traffic controller in public, he never heard this interference in his location, informing them, because it's ground wave and there's too much terrain in the way. But you take an aircraft of 3,000, 4,000 feet over the North Shore Island, he heard it fine. When I finally come up on this guy's location, he was putting out harmonic energy about minus 15, minus 20 dBc. So he wasn't tuned too terribly well. And that's how I got involved in finding a pirate radio station. That information was turned over to the FAA. I think they forwarded a copy of my email to the FCC. Don't know what happened to the guy after that.
When you pinned him down, did you pin him down to a private home? Is that where the broadcast was taking place? I think you said in Hollis, Queens, or go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I found him, and there was somebody else on another frequency. Inadvertently, I found them also within about half a mile of each other. This guy was very clever, though. And the neighborhood in Hollis, Queens, it's all Haitian, so it's like the kind of neighborhood you don't get out of your car unless you're armed, you know, that type of neighborhood. He was very clever. He was transmitting from a building behind his house. Looked like a two-story garage, and the antenna was actually in the attic, so you couldn't see it as you drove by. But, you know, I could see it by just doing some signal stepping, driving with a an Omni antenna on the vehicle, cut for the aircraft band. So it took me a little while to find it because I didn't have direct direction finding capability. But I've done that kind of stuff before, so it was found. The other guy, he had one just strapped to his chimney, and that would look like an FM broadcast antenna. He was very easy to find once it passed his house, but he wasn't the culprit though. This other guy was.
What was the kind of material that they were transmitting on 97.5? Was it their favorite kind of music in their their language? Was he doing it just because he wanted his neighborhood to hear native music? Or do you think he was getting a real cash flow out of it? What's your guess as to his possible motivation, Joe? Go ahead.
I wouldn't have a clue why the guy was on the air or what he was doing. I wouldn't have the clue whatsoever. You know, it was just reggae type of music, or whatever Haitian people like to listen to. That I didn't hear much of voices. Mostly recorded stuff. Every once in a while, you come out with a commercial or something like that, speaking in their, you know, broken English type of talk as they talk. But most of the time, it's just music. Right, one record or whatever, right next to the after another. But you know, this guy had no clue that he was hearing almost 21 megahertz away. And putting out, you know, harmonic energy like minus 15, minus 20 dBc. So I don't know what else he's doing to other people in other frequency bands, but he sure it was bothering the aircraft band at the particular time.
Dick, to HUC with a question.
Yeah, somebody said Dick and then Steve in that order. Who said Dick?
Me, Richie, and Trio. Yes. You know, that's called Trio. Spoken French, what they call, that's the language they speak in Haiti. It's called Creole. And all my attendants, you know, I have healthcare attendants here. They're all Haitian. I think they get into this type of work. It's a niche for them. They don't make a lot of money. It's probably ethnic stations in Creole. And, there could have been some cash flow, but that's my guess, Dick.
Thank you, Rich. And Steve, KT2HUC, go right ahead. Wait for the beep.
I was just curious how long ago this was, Dick.
Yeah, Joe's going to tell us how long ago. Maybe Joe's going to give us a guess as how many watts output the guy was doing it. And do you think he was getting away with it for like 6 months? Over to you, Joe.
This was around July. I did this about July 2007, so it goes back many, many years. I've never had a problem the pilot never had a problem with receiving Republic's, ground information after that. What probably happened is, this guy, we called the police to actually have a look at this other guy's stuff, because maybe we thought that he was might have had something to do with it, but the police went up to the guy's house and see if he knew this. He did know the other guy, because they're all buddies with each other, and they apparently this is what these people do. They take a blank spot on the band, they buy some equipment, and, turntables and a mic, and they bees on the air, you know?
82 NVB with a comment.
Mr. NVB, I think it's Bob, go ahead.
Yes, this is Bob, KD2 NVB. I can fill in a little bit on the cultural background. I concur with Rich and Tuio that they were speaking Creole. I'm a musician. I play saxophone, among other instruments. And just out of college in the late 70s, early 80s, I played in a Haitian band for about 3 years called the Magnum Band. You might have heard me playing on that station. And anyway, yeah, they were, there's a neighborhood, they might have been making money, but, you know, they were probably just playing their own music, their own culture. I've actually been over to Haiti with this band. I was in Martinique, Guadeloupe, French Guiana. We played in Paris. So anyway, I was just wanted to, just a little side note there. So I'm sure these guys obviously had no idea what they were, damage they were doing, but back over to you, Dick. Thanks.
Hey, Joe, you said this was a whole lot of years ago, like 2007. That's 11 years ago. To me, that's not a whole lot of years. That's fairly recent. I expect you to tell me that this took place in 1985 or something like that. For 2007, no way of knowing how long he had been doing it. Although I guess you can get a clue by your pilot friend. Was he getting the interference for a 1 month period or a 6 month period when he finally complained to you about it, and it took you another week to assemble the equipment and go out there and do the searching? So once again, make a guess, Joe. How long do you think that station, that pirate station, 97.5 was on the air? W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu for a comment.
I got stepped on by somebody making a comment. I wouldn't have a clue how long the guy was interfering like that, but, I mean, Jack doesn't fly his plane all the time. He just happened to be up, going up once to take a ride, do a check ride and thing. He stopped in Connecticut to get some fuel, and on the way back, he had difficulty hearing Republic Tower with instructions for him. And, you know, he wasn't going to go play direction finder in his aircraft. He's just basically trying to come back and land his plane, but he had quite a bit of difficulty hearing the tower. Now, of course, the tower never had a problem hearing him because, you know, ground to ground, they're, what, 30 miles apart between Farmingdale and Hollis, Queens. So he could hear all the aircraft just fine. He didn't have any receiving problem on the ground, but like I said, Jack was at like 3,000 or 4,000 feet over the north shore of Long Island, and he had quite a bit of difficulty.
Good information. And then from Riverhead, we got some information. Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu. Go ahead, Rich.
Hi.
Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu. We only heard one word. Maybe you don't have your PL turned on. Go ahead.
I'm coming in on Echolink. Can you hear me now? Because if you can, I'm doing a... let me see if you can hear me now, Dick.
We're hearing you beautiful now, Rich, go right ahead. W2BZ, K2RIW.
In 1973, I walked into a war in Israel, the Yom Kippur War, and before it broke out, it was about 6 days before it broke out, and there was a guy named A.B.I.E., Nathan, A.B. Nathan, who had like a 100-foot boat that he would anchor off in the Mediterranean, you know, Israel and Lebanon, and it was called the, I didn't even know this, it was called the Boat of Peace or whatever. And one thing that blows me out with this wiki about him is John Lennon, who I knew a little bit, John Lennon funded him buying the boat. Anyway, it was a big thing back then, and he would play a lot of rock and roll, which, you know, you couldn't get in 1973 in that part of the world. So, A.B. Nathan, if anybody wants to look him up. Thanks, Dick.
What's this got to do with it?
Okay, these are pirate radio stations. There's a subject being discussed right now. And so, Rich is telling us about a major private radio station, a pirate radio station operation that took place in the Mediterranean. There have been quite a few pirate radio stations in past years that were located in the Gulf of Mexico. Gulf of Mexico, I pronounce it wrong sometimes. And transmitting strong signals toward the United States. And there was a person who lived on Long Island, an electronic enthusiast who was not a ham radio operator, who used to be involved in one of those operations, or a great big abandoned steel ship, a rusting old steel ship was being used for private radio, for pirates radio. So, radio is something. There's all kinds of ways of doing it. And with some direction finding, you can find these guys, and the Friendly Candy Company will eventually stop them from doing it most of the time, although when it takes place offshore beyond the X number of mile limit, I'm not quite sure what the FCC does in that particular case. Okay, we've gone down the list of people who signed in with a question or a comment for the net. We're now going to go over to Roy's section. Dr. Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
Have you ever seen an FCC monitoring van?
I know for periods of time they existed. Sometimes they're underfunded, and sometimes for periods of time they don't exist. During the time that they did exist, tell me what you saw. K K2EJ, K2RIW.
Now, the last one I saw was about 9 months ago, and it's a Chevy Suburban. If you look very carefully at the top, the roof is actually all radome. The center console is built by Rockwell, and in the armrest is a spectrum analyzer, a couple of digital analyzers, various different kinds of modem decoders. It's really cool. And the center console display has the spectrum analyzer display, a DAP scan display. Really fancy stuff. You'd have enjoyed looking at it.
It sounds like a very specially constructed vehicle. Does it almost look like a plane's closed car from the outside if you don't know what you're looking at? I think you said there was a radome on the top that contained all the antennas. There was another question I was going to ask you along these lines. So, this thing is in frequent operation in the New York City area. Eric, go ahead.
The roof actually looks like a normal suburban roof, except it's a little taller. And if you tap on it, it doesn't sound like metal. It's kind of hollow in there. And by the way, they cover from AM broadcasts all the way up to, I think, 6 gigs. And I wish I could see the antenna structure underneath that radome, but that would have been quite interesting. And there's quite a few of them, and yes, we've called them into action for one particular thing dealing with pirate radio. I told you about the translator that I put up and the big gun pirate that was there that's no longer there. And then since they were in the neighborhood, they've been catching small little stations in the Bronx and a few other places. So they've been kind of busy. It seems like Edge Pie really is putting his finger on pirate FM broadcasters.
To Rio.
82 NVB.
You said, Eric, that they also had digital demodulators. If a person was transmitting digital, I guess he wouldn't be pirate radio. He could be making surreptitious, you know, secret transmissions in digital. But before I pick up the two people that wanted to add some further information, do you believe that many of the digital modes they could demodulate, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, for the broadcasters, you don't realize it, but the small translators, low-power transmitters, actually have to transmit IDs if they're not the main station. For example, my translator actually FSKs the call sign in CW. That's one type of demodulator they have. They can also demodulate RDS, which is the displays for the FM station. They can also demodulate DMR, P25. I don't know if they can do D-Star or Yaesu, but they also do NXDN, a number of the other smaller, lesser-known codecs for keyboard transmission of Motorola and Kenwood and a few others. And what else? They can also demodulate 8BSB, COFDM. That's as far as I know, but there may be more. I mean, I only got a few minutes in there. It's not like, you know, they gave me the 24-hour tour.
Sounds like a lot of fun. N2EL, go ahead, Rich, with wait for the beeps.
Stick. N2EL, I'll tell you what I think. Where they get these transmitters. If you go on eBay, go to where the ham radio section is, you see there are people selling these, I guess you call them illicit transmitters. Some of them run a lot of watts, and they sell amplifiers. So I wouldn't buy one, but they do. Dad Dickens to you.
I wonder if eBay knows that they're selling a piece of illegal equipment. Bob, I think it was N2NVB. Go right ahead, Bob.
KB2, I
I commented before, but I think I didn't get through. I believe I was doubling. Can you hear me now?
KB2NVB, K2IW is hearing you now. Sorry about that if you double tried.
Great. It's now wandered much further off the topic I'm commenting on, but I played in a Haitian band when I was just out of college. I'm a musician. I play saxophone. Between 1979 and 1982, I played with a band called the Magnum Band. We toured in Haiti, Martinique, Guadeloupe, French Guiana. We went to Paris, made a few records, and they could have been playing us on that station, but I don't agree with them interfering with air traffic, of course, but it's nice music. It's called Compa, C-O-M, let's spell like compass kind of, C-O-M-P-A-S, like French Creole kind of pronunciation. This is Bob, KD2NVB, back to net.
You had an interesting past, Bob. And sounds like you were doing that for a while. We're going to go over to Roy, AC2GS. And somewhere there, I'm going to try to squeeze in my little puzzle with reference to why does the bottom of your bicycle pump get hot? And the answer is a little bit different than you think. But Roy has his own, he's got a great big long list of all kinds of things. And we're going to be hearing tonight also about the TESS satellite, which is going to be launched tomorrow at 6 p.m. It's going to be looking at somewhere between 200 and 500,000 stars simultaneously looking for Earth-like exoplanets. But, Roy, AC2GS, K2RIW, you got it, Dr. Roy.
This is AC2GS. Thank you, Dick. And this is the science talk, or whatever you wish to call it. Keep in mind, as always, that if you can email me at mailbag@ac2gs.com for any topic that interests you and you want to have me talk about or talk about with me. So once again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. First things first, some news that's kind of weird and strange and such. You'll recall that I mentioned that there were two new organs discovered in the human body, which is an unusual thing, the interstitium and the mesentery. Well, unfortunately, in the fine tradition of Pluto, it's been taken back. There seems to be a lot of problems with definitions and semantics, and people are not happy with calling them organs yet. So bring that number from 80 back to 78. Keep in mind, of course, that almost no human being has 78 organs. It's a total of men and women's organs put together comes to 78. Also, very strangely, Fox News website, if you believe their website, discusses the possibility that the Earth will end April 23rd. They're not quite sure if it's Planet X or some kind of religious thing, but all the news is fit to print. And another strange thing that I saw on a website was that the European Parliament is discussing a proposal to grant personhood status to intelligent machines. So the next time you smack your radio around, you might be in trouble for something like that. Let me drop. I have a little presentation on chemistry for tonight, all the good things about helium. We sort of discussed helium and hydrogen a little bit about a month or so ago when I did a talk on thorium reactors. So I went back to helium, and I found a whole bunch of little things. So I'll give you the spiel, and there are bits and pieces where I'll pause and ask the audience if they want to participate. There's a couple of questions and such, and it should be fun. So first, let me drop. Okay. Helium was first discovered in the spectroscopic experiments involving the sun and was named after the Greeks, named for their Titan god of the sun, Helios. Helium is the second most abundant element in the universe, making up 24% by mass of all known light matter in the universe. Only hydrogen is more abundant, with 74% of the universe's light mass being made up of hydrogen. The 1% of the remaining light mass consists of all the other elements you've seen in those periodic tables. Here on Earth, most of the elements that have atomic numbers greater than uranium have decayed into lighter, more stable elements. Let me drop. Helium very rarely combines with any other elements. Atomic helium is the second least dense gas in nature. Left in the atmosphere, it will reach the outer edge of the atmosphere and float out into the vacuum of space. Atmospheric helium has a concentration of 5 parts per million in the upper atmosphere. Most of that is helium-4 with 2 protons and 2 neutrons. A much rarer helium isotope, helium-3, with 2 protons and only 1 neutron, makes up only 300 parts per million of all the solar helium. Commercial supplies of helium are obtained by extraction from natural gas. This is from helium embedded in the rock strata, and is often produced from the alpha decay of uranium and thorium through the radium-226 pathway, which has a half-life of 1,600 years, and radon-222, with a half-life of 3.8 years to days, which decays to helium-4. In addition, tritium decays into helium-3. It has been estimated that the atmospheric extraction of helium would cost approximately 10,000 times more than the present ground extraction method. Let me drop. Just to give you an idea of the consumer cost, Amazon sells something called a Worthington cylinder for 14.9 cubic foot tank of helium for $48. Helium has many uses, both commercially and in scientific research. It is used in the cooling of superconductors in commercial MRI devices, and it's an excellent material to supercool components. Recently, hard drives have started to be manufactured with helium gas-filled cavities. The less dense gas allows for more platters to be inserted and can run at higher speeds because of helium's drag coefficient being much lower than other gases. 5 platters were previously the maximum allowable until the use of helium gas was introduced. Now helium gas-containing hard drives can contain as many as 7 platters. At similar speeds, these new drives run 5 degrees cooler in centigrade than the usual gas-filled ones, and they run more quietly. Save 23% more energy. Helium-3 is being considered as possibly a very useful fuel for fusion power generators. Helium-3 and deuterium fuse to helium-4, releasing a stable proton and usable energy. While usable fuel for fusion reactors usually include deuterium fusing with tritium to produce usable energy plus an unstable fast neutron that decays into protons, electrons, and anti-electron neutrinos, and a lot of wide radiation. Let me drop. Although the moon has a much higher ratio of helium-3 to helium-4, that doesn't mean that it has pools of helium-3 washing against its shores. The moon's surface contains helium-3 in amounts of approximately 10 parts per billion. That's billion with a B. Where on Earth, the ratio is more like 5 parts per trillion with a T. Now, anyone have any thoughts why the moon seems to get more helium-3 than we have here on Earth? Anyone have any ideas?
Could it have anything to do with solar wind and ultraviolet, whatever, coming out of the sun, hitting the helium atoms on the moon and changing them? That's a pure guess on my part. Over to you, Roy.
AC2IS with another guess.
Yes, Bill, guess away.
I am guessing, based on what you said previously, that somehow this helium is able to escape from the Earth, and that somehow the Earth's helium is drifting over to the moon, but that other atmospheric components are not. AC2IS.
Okay, let me give people a little bit of help here. The helium-3 is all produced in the sun, in the solar wind. So it's not being transmuted. It can occur in the decay of tritium normally. But for the most part, the helium-3 that I'm talking about is solar helium-3. So it's spraying out across the solar system. What's the difference in the planet Earth versus the moon? What does one have that the other doesn't?
KV2-HUC with a yes.
Yes away.
Atmosphere. I'm going to say an atmosphere, because it doesn't look like helium-3 has a polarity, so I doubt it's the magnetic field of Earth, so probably the atmosphere.
Okay, so you think it's bouncing off the atmosphere. Anyone else with any other ideas?
Earth also has a magnetosphere, ACTIS.
That is quite true, Bill. Now, do you think that helium-3 or helium-4 has a magnetic domain?
I do not know how helium would react to a magnetic field. Not sure about that. ACTIS.
Okay, anyone else with any other opinions?
Please, ACTIS, I'm still around the Earth.
One doubled with you, Eric.
I'm suggesting, how about the Van Allen belt around the Earth? It's not only magnetic, there's plasma and all sorts of good stuff.
Okay, but that would kind of assume that this is a charge, that helium-3 has a charge, and then why would it go to the moon? So it's close, and it's a good guess. But there was someone doubling with you. Did they have any guesses?
JXM.
Yes, JXM.
Hi, I'm guessing that the helium-3 is carried along with the solar wind, and since the solar wind is deflected by the magnetosphere, the helium-3 goes along with that and is not carried to Earth, WB2GXM.
Okay, well, they're all great guesses. The problem is that... As someone mentioned, there's a great magnetic field that surrounds and protects us from a lot of dangerous cosmic rays. You might ask why magnetic fields should have really anything to do with this. After all, you learned on a previous science talk that magnetism is due to charged particles that possess some net angular or linear velocity, like unpaired electrons. The helium has two paired electrons. Their spin cancels each other. But what about the protons? Well, the protons also are two, and their spins cancel each other out as well. So you get unopposed. Where do you get unopposed charged spin coming from? And that's the thing about helium-3 and helium-4. If you remember when I mentioned it, helium-3 has one neutron. Helium-4 has two neutrons. And although neutrons have a net zero charge, they're not chargeless. They're a mess of positives and negatives that net zero charge. In point of fact, neutrons have this very strange configuration that they're supposedly charged negative in the center, then charged positively above it like a lollipop, and then over a coat of another negative charge. So the fact that helium-3 has one neutron that's spinning is enough to give it a magnetic moment and enough to repel it right away from the Earth's magnetosphere. So that's the reason why we get very little helium-3, because although helium-3 is not very magnetic, it's magnetic enough to be repelled by our magnetosphere. Everyone knows that helium is light. What might happen if you blew up two identical balloons to the same exact size and filled one with helium, the other with hydrogen gas, then tie two balloons together to a single string and place the string in a simple pulley device on the floor? Where would the two balloons settle at eventually?
VDH with a comment?
Yes, VDH.
Yes.
Yeah, I think the hydrogen is slightly lighter than the helium. Go ahead.
Okay, so like I said, would this kind of rise slightly above it? Would it rise all the way up and the helium sink to the bottom? How do you think things would work out?
I think the hydrogen would rise to the top, since they wouldn't have the hydrogen would have more of a lift. Go ahead.
Okay, very good. Now, any guess of the different relative density of hydrogen and helium?
Hydrogen is lighter, therefore hydrogen has a lesser density, ACTOS.
No, that's quite true. But given the fact that hydrogen has one proton and helium has two protons and two neutrons, roughly, would you say, what would be the difference in the two densities of a balloon full of hydrogen and a balloon full of helium? Just from knowing what the little bits and pieces that make it up are.
Oh, well, based on how they're composed, you would think the helium would be lighter, but that's not counting how close hydrogen atoms can get together and how close helium atoms can get together or want to get together. And those pieces of information are not known to me. All I know is that hydrogen is lighter, ACTOS.
I think hydrogen is diatomic and helium is monatomic.
Question. Normally, if you were just talking about monatomic gases and assuming that they were ideal gases just to make life easier on all of us, it would be a 1-4 difference in density. But because hydrogen does not really exist in nature around us, unless you ionize it and really excite it, it remains in a H2 gas. It has two neutrons and two protons, rather. So effectively, hydrogen is half the density of helium, and that's really what it amounts to. Because, you know, sometimes people just look upon hydrogen as 1 and helium as 4, and so it's 1-4. But you also have to consider the fact that you don't get free hydrogen out there.
Because the hydrogen H2 is half the mass of helium, HE1, so to speak, it's very tempting to want to use hydrogen for lighter-than-air craft, as they did with the Hindenburg. But, oh boy, do you accept an awful lot of vulnerability because of flammability. Over to you, ACTGS, you got it right.
Yes, Eric first, and someone else afterwards.
No, I have a question. Although we're talking about atomic weight, how many molecules of H2 can you put in the balloon, and in the same volume, how many molecules of the helium can you put in the balloon? Do they occupy the same space?
Here comes the ideal gas law. You got it right.
Well, yeah, for the sake of the ideal gas law, given the same pressure, you have the same exact number of moles. That's Otherwise, if it didn't quite work that way, you couldn't really factor in the atomic number to give you the density of a gas.
My way of rewording that one, Roy, is that the number of, let me call them molecules, of an ideal gas, where you fix the temperature and pressure, you get the exact same number of molecules, no matter which one of the gases it is. And when you go through the calculation as to that number of molecules and that much volume, you come to the conclusion that each molecule is on average 3.5 nanometers, roughly 3.5 nanometers away from his nearest neighbor. So each of those molecules of a gas are 3.5 nanometers roughly apart, and the exact same number of them per cubic meter, so to speak, no matter what the gas is. I'm rounding out the numbers quite a bit, but it's close. Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
But, Dick, that's at one atmosphere, correct? 760 torr, right?
Yeah, I started off saying you fix the temperature and the pressure. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, and usually I particularly like the way that chemistry came up with the number of atoms or molecules in a given sample. They're usually defined as a mole, which is 6.02 times 10 to the 23rd either atom or molecule. It'll give you the weight in grams of whatever it is, their atomic weight. So in other words, if you have some kind of a molecule that has an atomic weight of 12, if you have one mole of it, it will weigh 12 grams. So that's the usual unit of number of atoms or molecules in a system.
Roy, is that number 6.023 times 10 to the 23rd, is that magic number given a specific name?
Yes, it is named after Avogadro, and it's called Avogadro's number.
That's a nice thing to remember. It's kind of hard to believe that whether you choose a very heavy gas, a very light gas, whatever, you choose a room temperature and ordinary room pressure, and you get the exact same number of molecules there all the time. Isn't that crazy that Mother Nature, when it comes to big molecules or small molecules, she doesn't change the number of molecules per cubic meter? What makes Mother Nature want to do that? Or are you, Roy?
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Is there a third gas that would work? I was wondering. I know you go up the periodic chart. Does it stop at helium? That's it.
What? I think that's your last lighter than air gas, because you have to cross the entire periodic table and get back to, I think neon is the next gas in the periodic table, and that's not going to very far.
Very good. How about a combination of hydrogen and helium? Did they ever try that? You know, maybe that would make it less explosive, but more buoyant.
Comment?
Yes, comment away.
Of hydrogen.
Right, this is K1MJM, Mike number two. You were talking about balloons. The buoyancy difference between hydrogen and helium is about 7% better with hydrogen.
Okay. As far as mixing hydrogen and helium, I think people would be concerned that although it would diminish the combustion tendency of the hydrogen, it wouldn't completely rid yourself of it, and you're still spending the time and the money on the helium. So I'm not aware of anyone really doing a lot of helium-hydrogen mixtures. They either went with one or, for the most part, went with the other.
Let me guess here, Roy. If I use a 50% hydrogen-helium mixture, quite possibly that is non-explosive, and during the time it's a mixture, it might be very hard to light that one on fire. because you've got a